Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
It is not a season-ending event. This will cause a lull in fire activity that could easily pick up.
Meteorologists say wetter weather is helping with fires, but that could still change quickly. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 12th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, in response to a federal lawsuit, the state says the Kuskokwim River isn't public for the purposes of fisheries management.
And that's a big claim, because if the Kuskokwim River, one of the state's biggest rivers, isn't public land, what is?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Authorities are searching for a single-engine plane that did not arrive in Sutton as expected last night. The red and white Aranca Champion was expected in Sutton about 6:30 p.m. That's about 90 minutes after it was reported to have left Valdez on Monday. Alaska State Troopers say search efforts were hampered today by poor weather, including heavy cloud cover. Aircraft are flying when they can. Flash flooding has closed a stretch of the Richardson Highway in the eastern Alaska Range. The State Department of Transportation's 511 site lists the highway as closed from mileposts 218 to 233 in the Black Rapids area. A DOT announcement posted earlier this morning says high water closed bridges at Ruby Creek and One Mile Creek. That's in addition to a washout earlier in the day that closed the nearby Bear Creek Bridge. DOT says repair times are unknown due to weather conditions. A National Weather Service statement says snowmelt caused by high freezing levels in the Alaska Range combined with heavy rains are resulting in high water. It says glacier-fed rivers like the Nabesna, Shoshona, and Tanana are running bankful and warns of possible flooding in low-lying areas along the Tanana, including Fairbanks' Rosie Creek subdivision. More than 17,000 lightning strikes hit Alaska and neighboring Canadian territories yesterday. Most of the strikes were concentrated between the Brooks and Alaska ranges in the central and eastern half of Alaska. The Alaska Interagency Coordination Center reported 13 new wildfire starts in the last 24 hours, but many of the thunderstorms have dropped rain as a shift to cooler, wetter weather progresses. Fire Information Officer Jose Acosta says wildfire activity is slowing, but meteorologists are not calling the season yet.
It is not a season-ending event. This will cause a lull in fire activity that could easily pick up.
Acosta says new fire crews from the lower 48 are being flown into the state this week to replace crews who are required to take time off. Over 1,000 firefighters are working in the state. As of this afternoon, there were 267 active fires, 15 of which were being fought. More than 2.8 million acres have burned so far this season. Well, a lawsuit between the federal and state governments could drastically change how subsistence fishing is managed across all of Alaska. This spring, the feds sued the state over conflicting management policies for salmon fishing on the Kuskokwim River. The federal government's position is that rural subsistence fishers should get priority in management decisions. But the state doesn't recognize a rural preference for fishing and says its Department of Fish and Game should be in charge, not the feds. As James Brooks with the Alaska Beacon reports, the state seems to be preparing for a long fight over the issue, and Brooks says the state's recent response in the ongoing lawsuit signals there could be much wider implications.
In 2021 and this year as well, both the Federal Subsistence Board and Fish and Game have issued different orders saying when fishermen can fish and for how long. And they each have different ideas because the number of fish in the river has gone down so much, they need to be really careful not to overfish.
And I guess at the heart of it, like you said, there's different ideas about how to manage this area. The Fed's position is that there should be a rural subsistence preference for that area, for those type of fish, for Chinook and chum salmon. And the state has tried to open it up to any Alaskan resident to fish. Is that right?
That's right, because the Alaska Constitution says that all fishermen are created equal, effectively. There's no way under the Alaska Constitution to have a rural preference for fishermen. So somebody in Anchorage would have the same rights to fish as somebody in Aniak.
Gotcha. And hasn't that been argued in court before? Isn't there the Katie John decision that people throw that case name around? Doesn't that apply in this?
Yeah. And that's the issue at hand is, does this case over the Kuskokwim, does it threaten to rewrite the book on Katie John? Because that series of court cases, which went to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, has been what the state and federal government have been working with for about 20 years.
So fast forward to just a couple days ago, basically, the state has filed a response in that lawsuit. What does the state say?
So the state has 7 different affirmative defenses, the reasons that they say the Federal Subsistence Board is acting inappropriately and that the state should have priority. And number 4 is a big one. It says the Federal Subsistence Board lacks jurisdiction over the Kuskokwim River because it is not public land under ANILCA. And that's a big claim, because if the Kuskokwim River, one of the state's biggest rivers, isn't public land, what is? Is the Yukon River not public land? Is the Copper River not public land? It effectively breaks down the interpretation that was set by the Katie John cases and has the effect potentially of drastically altering how subsistence fishing is managed across the state.
So this seems like a big deal. It comes across in this court filing, you know, in legalese and in response to different parts of the lawsuit. So it's a little bit tough to read through the whole thing. But when you reached out to the state about this, about the reasoning for this filing, what did the state say about it?
The state said that the right to manage the state's own resources was a primary driver for statehood, and that state primacy wasn't changed with the passage of ANILCA back in 1980. And their argument is that the federal government is seeking to expand federal authority rather than just maintain it.
Have you heard any response from rural subsistence users to this latest filing by the state, this contention that the state should be in charge?
Yeah, ATNA Incorporated, attorneys representing them, have filed to intervene in the lawsuit and have laid things out much more clearly, saying that if the state's interpretation is upheld by a federal court, the Katie John precedent is in real danger of being changed.
Well, James, in light of other huge decisions at the federal level by the U.S. Supreme Court, and just looking at how big of a case this could be, do you have any sense that this could end up either before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals or the U.S. Supreme Court somewhere down the road?
Well, this is such an early step in the case. The case is only 2 months old. If it goes that direction, we're talking years rather than months. But in a request for proposals that was filed on Friday, the state said it's looking for a outside legal firm to represent it during this case. It said it's only looking for somebody in trial court right now and is prepared to spend $250,000 on that. But one of the requirements to hire that firm is that its lead attorney must have argued in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. And that seems to me like it's a pretty big hint of the state's intent.
At least that they would be preparing for that possibility, I guess.
Yes.
That was Alaska Beacon reporter James Brooks. You can read his full story at alaskabeacon.com. Still to come in Alaska News Nightly, subsistence users say commercial vessels are taking fish bound for Western Alaska rivers.
We need our fish, and we're the end users. They're there just for the money.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Money is generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
In the wake of chum salmon crashes in Western Alaska, subsistence fishermen have been pleading with the state to restrict salmon fishing near the Alaska Peninsula. Subsistence users say commercial vessels are taking fish bound for their rivers. In part one of a three-part series, KYUK's Olivia Eberts introduces a place known as Area M, where subsistence and commercial interests collide.
Kuskokwim fisherman Fritz Charles grew up on the Lower River with plenty of fish, so many that his parents would put away literal barrels of them. His job as a child was to pack the dry fish in tight, using a special method.
Somebody would put me in the drum and start stomping on the fish so they can pack more in there. They put away two drums of salmon. One drum would mainly be king slabs, and the other one would be chums and reds. And that was our main diet for the whole winter back then.
Nowadays, there's no more stomping on dry fish. That's because there aren't enough to put away a whole barrel. Chinook runs have been low in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region for a long time, and chum runs had been faltering as well, but they were still dependable, up until last year. In 2021, chum runs took a sharp downward turn. It was the worst year on record for them on the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers. Now, this year's chum run is at its second lowest. There are many theories behind the salmon crash. Most scientists have attributed it to issues out at sea. Many have theorized that climate change is negatively impacting the salmon's ocean environment. But Charles and many other local fishermen have another theory.
They're being slaughtered out in the sea.
They're concerned about one part of Alaska waters in particular.
Tribes are completely ignored about Area M.
I'd like to know how much gross domestic product is coming out of Area M.
I'm anxious to hear about Area M.
Area M is of huge importance to the AYK region.
Area M is a state-managed section of water near the Aleutian Islands. It's called an intercept fishery because most fish caught there originated elsewhere. They must pass through Area M on the way back to their spawning grounds. And in June, ocean-going vessels there scoop up fish bound for coastal Western Alaska. The fishermen primarily target sockeye, but they also catch and sell chum and Chinook salmon. There have been repeated clashes over regulating this intercept fishery for decades, but the battle gained new energy following last year's summer chum crash. Last summer, the chum run on the Yukon River was down to a tenth of its average run size. The river was missing about 1.5 million fish. Also last summer, Area M commercial fishermen caught about 1.2 million chum at sea, while subsistence fishing on the rivers was closed. In the midst of the smallest chum run Western Alaska subsistence users had ever seen, Area M fishermen were catching more than ever before. Even the Commissioner of Fish and Game, Doug Vincent Lang, who's been hesitant to over-restrict the Area M commercial fishery, acknowledged last year's record-high numbers.
We got surprised and the numbers got added up at the end of the season, just how large that harvest was.
Fritz Charles and other subsistence users say that Area M commercial fishermen are stealing their livelihoods. But the Area M fishermen believe they have a claim to the fish too. Fritz Charles says the fish belong to the Yupik people. The Yupik have been stewards of the fish for thousands of years. Plus, he says, he only takes what his family needs to survive on the land.
We need our fish, and we're the end users. They're just for the money.
He says fishing for salmon is his culture, and with the low runs, it's been harder and harder to pass his traditions on to his children. Over in Area M, Safran Kuznetsov surveys the scene.
I'm fishing in the Ilnik section near Stroganoff Point.
Kuznetsov is a fisherman from Voznesenka, a town near Homer. He says, like Fritz Charles, his culture depends on fishing too. Like Charles, he grew up fishing.
I am an old believer, and culturally, gill netting is a way of life for old believers.
Old believers are from a branch of Russian Orthodoxy that fled persecution in Russia long ago and eventually ended up in Alaska.
They were looking for a similar climate to grow traditional foods and some place with the ability to live off the land.
Kuznetsov says if the June fishery were to be shut down or more tightly regulated, it would be a devastating blow to his community and to his livelihood too.
There's a saying here that 90% of our annual income is earned in 2 weeks when the hot run hits.
Kuznetsov mainly targets sockeye, but he sometimes catches chum and chinook too. So do the subsistence fishermen in the YK Delta or the commercial fishermen like Kuznetsov in Area M have a greater claim to the chum? Well, about a decade ago, a comprehensive salmon genetic study of the Area M fishery confirmed that most of the chum caught in the region are bound for coastal western Alaska, about 60%. But you can break that number down a lot more. More on that next time. For now, I'm Olivia Eberts in Bethel.
In part two of the series, we'll look at what science can tell us about whether commercial fishing in Area M is truly taking a toll on western Alaska salmon populations. A section of the Alaska Highway that washed out earlier this month has been circumvented. According to Yukon Highways and Public Works, the July 1st washout occurred 125 kilometers north of Liard Hot Springs, south of the Yukon border in British Columbia, and closed the road for several days. The British Columbia Ministry of Transportation and Infrastructure 511 page says the washout has since been routed around with a single-lane road over which drivers are being guided by pilot vehicles. Meanwhile, stretches of other roads recently closed in the Yukon due to wildfires have reopened. Yukon Highways and Public Works Communications Manager Kristen Johnson says two major highways reopened yesterday, the Robert Campbell Highway between Watson Lake and Ross River and the North Klondike Highway between Pelly Crossing and Stewart Crossing.
The North Klondike Highway affects people who are driving up to Dawson City and beyond onto Top of the World Highway. So travelers who are driving up that way still may experience some delays as the North Klondike Highway is still under a travel advisory. We're just keeping our eye on wildfire conditions, and we have a pilot vehicle that are taking vehicles across when it's safe to do so.
Johnson says travelers heading over any roads in the Yukon should be prepared for delays and should be self-sufficient as some communities have limited supplies due to recent road closures. She also recommends drivers check 511 Yukon for the latest travel conditions.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
The MV Tustamina returns to service this week. That's the only Alaska Marine Highway System ferry that sails between all 13 ports of call out the Aleutian chain and regularly visits Kodiak Island. The MV Kennecott has been the only ferry sailing to Kodiak since the nearly 60-year-old Tusty went into the shipyard for repairs back in December. The Tustamina's first sailing since then will be on Saturday when it departs Homer on its way to Kodiak. Sam Dapsovich is with the Alaska Department of Transportation.
The Kennecott's been pulling double duty trying to fill in for Tustamina, but obviously it doesn't provide as many runs as the Tustamina's normal schedule, so it'll be nice to have that boat back out there and doing what it does best.
The Kennecott was able to serve most of the Tustamina's port calls, but not all of them. Several communities in the Aleutians have had to skip ferry service altogether because the Kennecott is too large to make it into their smaller ports. A replacement is in the works for the aging Tustamina, but the more than $200 million project isn't expected to be completed for another 5 years. Dapsovich says DOT hopes to begin construction on the replacement vessel next year. Dip nets are hitting the water at the beaches in Kenai. The personal use fishery opened Sunday and will run through the end of the month, providing a chance for Alaska residents to catch sockeye salmon and fill their freezers from the mouth of the Kenai River. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
It's still early in the run for the city-run fishery. Popularity usually peaks at the middle of the month. Diane Granfors of Anchorage says it's the earliest she's been down in the decade she's been dip netting.
I'm retired now, so I'm able to kind of go when I want, and the tides were right.
Still, she says the fish are running. Around 1 p.m. Monday, she's detangling a sockeye from her dip net at North Kenai Beach.
It's really calm, so that's really nice. I'm not getting beat by the surf. And we've just been steadily hitting fish since we got here.
Marlene and Kevin McNeil are further down the shore, standing behind a line of 7 grandkids, all with their nets in the water.
We wait for this the entire fishing season. We decided to move down here because of the fishing.
The McNeils have a home in Soldotna. Kevin says their grandkids love to come down to visit. They range in age from 9 to 14.
A good amount. Every one of our family have got fish, which is always exciting for the little ones to catch fish, yep. So,
he says they like to come down on weekdays when it's quieter. He remembers the fishery being a lot less popular when it first started.
It was kind of an unknown thing. Now it's been so well advertised, everybody and their brother comes. But luckily, there's still a lot of good fish left.
Growth in the fishery hasn't been linear. Participation depends in part on how the sockeye run is doing. Colton Lipka with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game says participation has actually decreased in the Kenai in the last few years, as it subsequently increased on the Kisilof. The department marked almost 21,000 household days fished for the Kenai River dipnet fishery last year. That's in contrast with nearly 33,000 a decade earlier. Still, it's a huge jump since the fishery's inception in 1996. One aspect of that increased participation is an increase in trash along the dipnet beaches. The volunteer-run Streamwatch program has booths at beaches in Kenai and Kisilof to educate dipnetters about reporting requirements and watershed stewardship. Streamwatch also runs a weekly program called Trashercise during dipnet season. Volunteers pick up litter and trash at the North Kisilof beach between 5 to 7 p.m. every Tuesday. Back on the beach in Kenai, Kevin and Marlene McNeil are thinking about what they're going to do with the fish they catch.
We like to vacuum seal it. We make a lot of strips. I do pickled fish.
They'll also send some of the fish to Marlene's mother, who lives in northwestern Alaska.
We share to elders who don't get an opportunity to be here, so we, of course, share with a lot of elders as well as other family members that can't make it down here. And that's what it's all about.
A household permit in Upper Cook Inlet allows for a harvest of 25 sockeye per head of household and 10 additional fish for every member of that household. Only Alaska residents are allowed to dip net. Dipnetters must have sport fishing licenses and personal use permits. Anglers must report their catches online by August 15th and are required to clip the tail fins of any fish they catch. Dipnetters are also not allowed to keep king salmon. That emergency order is triggered by restrictions on the sport fishery, where catching kings is also prohibited due to low king counts. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
The city and borough of Juneau needs to make good on its plans to combat the local effects of climate change. That's one of the takeaways from a climate report released today. The study, undertaken by a research center at the University of Alaska Southeast, is meant to inform citizens and serve as a baseline information for city leaders. Jim Powell is a UAS research professor and its lead author.
There are two messages. One, there are many impacts. Two, we are doing something about it. For a small community, that's pretty impressive.
In Juneau, precipitation has already increased by 20 inches a year in the last century and will continue to rise. Ocean warming will stress local marine ecosystems. More landslides will happen as the region gets warmer and wetter. Powell says the study comes with recommendations that are within reach on a local level.
Local government is able to move forward when polarization is occurring at the national side and state side. Local governments are making it happen, and that's why this report is really important, because we're looking at the impacts as well as the things that we can do and things that we've done.
The city has already taken some steps to address climate change. Juneau was the first port in the world to connect cruise ships to hydropower in 2001, and it's considering expanding that program from one dock to three. The study recommends going even further than that, investing in 100% shore power for all cruise ships, limiting the number of ships in port to 5, and monitoring ship emissions while in port. Powell praised the city for setting a goal to have 80% renewable energy by 2045 and for having a plan in place to address climate. But the study recommends the city go further by creating metrics to report progress on its goals to the public.
It's important to have goals. If you don't have indicators, you can't manage. If you haven't have goals, you can't manage.
The study was made possible by a volunteer effort from more than two dozen Alaska scientists, most of them living in Juneau. Funding came from the City and Borough of Juneau and the Department of the Interior. The international shipping industry is a huge contributor to global greenhouse gases. All of those container ships that cross the Pacific from, say, China to the United States, they're largely run on petroleum. The industry emits about 1 billion tons of CO2 into the atmosphere every year. So a group of researchers are looking into what it would take to transition petroleum-run ships into using zero-emission fuels. And what they found could put the Aleutian Islands right at the center of it all. KUCB's Theo Greenlee has more.
It started with a problem. How can we ship containers across the Pacific Ocean using renewable resources? Researchers from the International Council on Clean Transportation have been trying to figure that out, and they found a potential solution. Hydrogen. Elise Georgieff is an associate researcher with the nonprofit.
How many container ships across the Trans-Pacific corridor could make it on liquid hydrogen? And it was about 43%. They could be powered by hydrogen using fuel cells.
Fuel cells are sort of like batteries. But instead of holding a charge from another source, they create a charge from the fuel they store. Georgieff says her group found that almost half of the ships that travel from China to California could make the exact same trip with hydrogen fuel cells. But what about the other half? They would need a midway point for the ships to refuel along the way.
We found, yes, like 99% of the ships that couldn't make the Pacific route before, if they just added one refueling stop, just like a little gas stop on the way, they could obtain the route.
Most of the international ships crossing from east to west follow the same path. And Unalaska and Adak and the Aleutian Islands, they're right in the middle, about halfway through one of the world's busiest shipping lanes. It's what some are calling a green corridor.
So we're hypothesizing because of their strategic location, they could be a first player in this green corridor that's already been talked about between China and the United States.
The United Nations has called for global leaders to work towards decarbonization of maritime shipping. And Georgieff says Alaska is poised to be a key player in that future. The Biden administration has pledged to work with the UN to develop hydrogen and renewable energies in the American shipping industry. And this international study estimates a market of more than $1 billion a year if the Aleutians become a full-fledged hydrogen hub. Reporting in on Alaska, I'm Theo Greenlee.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Olivia Eberts in Bethel, Kirsten Dobroth in Kodiak, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Claire Strempel in Juneau, and Theo Greenlee in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby. Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 45 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.